Hey, John, it's John Lamb calling.
How you doing, John?
Good.
So I'm sort of torn because on the one hand, I want to go very deep and talk about a lot of stuff that will be of interest to dynamic language junkies. But at the same time, I really would like to find a way to motivate this discussion for people who aren't necessarily dynamic language junkies and in a sense might not even be deep into programming at all.
Right.
Well, I got a very nice insight into why it would matter generally from Avi Bryant when I talked to him about DabbleDB, which is built on top of the Squeak, the Smalltalk VM. He made a really nice observation, which is that the philosophy of DabbleDB really mirrors the philosophy of the dynamic language runtime in the sense that everything you do in DabbleDB is live.
Yes.
And it's like you're working in the Smalltalk VM, right? You make changes and they are instantly reflected. You can kind of play with your data like it was clay and mold it and change it while the application is running. You know, I thought that that was a nice way of kind of bringing this up a level to people and saying, you know, this isn't just, I mean, it is obviously, of course, hugely about programmer productivity, but it is also about making things that are very nice for everyone to use.
Yes.
And so I thought I would just, you know, invite you to maybe start there, and then we can dig into what the history of what your history has been with Ruby and with .NET and how you're bringing them together and what you're announcing at Mix and so on.
Sure. So let's start by, do you want to start just with talking about the announcements at Mix?
Let's do that.
So the really interesting thing about what we're announcing at Mix is the dynamic language runtime. The dynamic language runtime started off as Iron Python. So Iron Python was a project to see, well, can we implement a very high-performing as well as very compliant implementation of the Python dynamic language on top of the CLR? And so lots and lots of challenges came out of that, but you know, I think in the end, the Iron Python implementation pretty well proves both of those points, right? It's a very compliant implementation, and it's also currently the fastest implementation that's out there. Now, once Iron Python got created, then it was, well, so maybe we want to try and see what other languages we can build on top of, dynamic languages we can build on top of the CLR. And let's see what parts out of the Iron Python experience can be factored out into a set of libraries that could be useful to other people trying to build other dynamic languages.
Can I just clarify for myself? Because
Sure.
there's a level at which dynamic language support in .NET means improvements to the virtual machine. And there have been, over the last few years, I've heard about that off and on. So that's one level of support. But this is another level of support, really, which is a framework class library that's layered on top of the runtime, right?
That's right.
So.
But keep in mind that library in Iron Python itself heavily leverages features inside of the CLR.
Right.
And perhaps the most useful feature for implementing dynamic languages on top of the CLR are dynamic methods. And that was introduced in CLR 2.0.
Right.
And this is a mechanism whereby we can essentially generate little collectible functions. And they are fully collectible by the GC, which means that we can generate as much code as you want. And when that code's not being used again, you know, poof, right, the GC will come along and do its thing.
Okay.
This kind of stuff is done quite often inside of dynamic languages, which is generating lots of little methods that do interesting things.
Right.
That's the underlying CLR feature that we are heavily leveraging in lots and lots and lots of the work that we have here.
Okay.
The libraries have to solve other problems, right? So problems such as dynamic dispatch, right? How do I figure out which method to invoke on this object reference?
Right.
Right. Keeping in mind that these objects can change over time, right? You know, unlike a statically typed language, which at compile time you know about all types. All types are essentially frozen, right, at compile time. In a dynamic language, things can change, so you have performance implications here, right? Which is, well, okay, do I actually have to walk through my entire graph in order to try and figure out which method to invoke at this point, or are there mechanisms for us to make that faster through caching?
Right.
We can optimize dynamic method dispatch considerably by essentially realizing that most of the time when you're invoking a method on an object from a particular call site, that generally that object doesn't change.
So the DLR is, among other things, providing some caching services?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So essentially to cache the method lookup. So once we've figured out what method to call, right, we can cache it at a call site. Right?
Okay.
So that has something changed, yes or no, and if it hasn't changed, then we just call.
Okay.
Every single dynamic language effectively at some point has to implement those kinds of facilities. Right? So rather than everyone having to reinvent the wheel or come up with their own slower implementations, they can use the one runtime implementation of this this feature. And as we make improvements to that technology over time, they're just going to essentially pick up the benefits for free.
So this was cooked up in the context of the IronPython project, and now you're the first other client of it, in effect.
We are, as a proof of concept, implementing four different dynamic languages on top of the DLR. So there's, of course, Python in its refactored form, right, to use the new DLR. There is managed JavaScript.
Okay.
There is Visual Basic, and there is Ruby.
Okay.
And Ruby, of course, was the big language, right, that we hadn't previously been talking about working on until now. But implementing Ruby on top of the DLR is going to be an interesting set of challenges in its own right. One of the key reasons why we want to have these four languages, right, and these four languages are quite different from each other, is to essentially validate this concept as well as to act as a forcing function on the DLR itself, right, to cause it to change, right? Because if you really want to make the claim that you have this runtime that can run multiple languages, you really need to have multiple languages actually running on it.
The initial Ruby CLR project was a bridge implementation as opposed to the kind of an implementation that IronPython is. So is this changing?
Ruby CLR was a project that I created before I joined Microsoft.
Yes.
And it was the quickest route to get from A to B, right? And that was, as a Ruby programmer, I wanted to use the .NET libraries. So what Ruby CLR really did was acted as an interop layer, much like what the COM interop layer does inside of .NET today.
Or comparable to other implementations that had been around for other languages, like Perl.NET and Python.NET.
So bridges are really useful in the sense that the language is still the language. You know, nothing has changed in the language at all. We're just adding features to the language.
Yes.
All of your libraries, and especially in scripting languages, right, which generally wind up delegating to C for a lot of things.
Yes.
You know, regular expression support and those kinds of things, right? You don't have to implement any of that stuff. It's just there, it works, but I'm just bringing the types inside of .NET into that world.
Right.
But one of the really attractive ideas about running dynamic languages on top of the CLR is also integrating the languages with each other.
Mm-hmm.
I could have some chunk of code that I found somewhere that was written in Python, right? And I happen to be a Ruby programmer, but I really want to use this Python library, then I can just go off and call it directly, right,
yes,
from my Ruby code.
Yes. We saw a nice example of this in the screencast that I did with Jim Huguenin.
Uh-huh.
Of interop between Python, IronPython code and VB code, actually.
Right.
VB.NET code, yeah. So absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. The interesting things are dynamic language to dynamic language interop, as well as dynamic language to static library interop as well.
Yeah.
That becomes really, really interesting. And one of the things that Jim and I are doing a joint talk at Mix, and in our talk what we're doing is we're building this application by stealing bits of code from other samples.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of mashing them all together to generate this one end-to-end thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we're using five languages, right? We're using the four dynamic languages in the DLR, as well as some code that was written in C# as well. And we're doing this all within the context of the other thing that we announced at Mix, which is Silverlight.
Right.
So Silverlight is this client-side runtime piece, right, for writing these rich applications that run entirely inside of the browser on both Mac and Windows.
Is it the case that your new implementation of Ruby will run on the Silverlight runtime?
Absolutely, yes.
Excellent.
You know, we've been spending a lot of time coming up to Mix is getting our languages to work with the Silverlight runtime, right? Because that's a very important host for us, right? So one of the other interesting things about DLR is this notion of hosting.
Let me just clarify, in case it's not completely clear to someone who's listening. So what this will mean is that currently Ruby CLR keeps the Ruby C runtime around. It will not need to be hanging around for this stuff, right?
Right, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So we are building a from the ground up implementation of the Ruby language that will compile straight into IL. That gives us all sorts of other things, right? It gives us a whole bunch of problems, right? In the sense that, you know, oh my God, we have to now implement regular expression support the Ruby way, right? Not necessarily the .NET way, and, you know, and port a bunch of libraries over as well,
yeah,
which are considered core to Ruby. And some of those libraries being C libraries, right, aren't just going to run. right? Like any library from the Ruby world that is 100% Ruby should just run on our implementation. But it's all the C ones that are the problematic ones.
Yeah, it's the same with IronPython.
Absolutely.
And I've actually been in the situation of mixing IronPython and CPython, not in the same application, obviously, but sort of side by side, because, you know, you do sort of need to have a foot in both worlds, at least for some transitional period.
Yes. Yes.
So this native Ruby in the Silverlight runtime in the browser sounds wildly cool on the face of it, but let's kind of, you know, plumb what that could mean, what that could do.
This is a platform that really didn't exist before, at least for Ruby, right? And that is being able to write code that runs entirely on the client and write all of that code inside of Ruby.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Ajax, of course, being the dominant way that people build things today, but the language there is JavaScript.
Yes.
It's a very difficult language for programming in the medium or the large. And by medium and large, I'm going to say, you know, applications that exceed, say, 5 to 10,000 lines of code.
Yeah.
Once my JavaScript gets up to that, I have a really hard time maintaining that stuff. Because modularity is definitely one of the things that isn't really all that well thought out in the JavaScript language, which is much, much better in languages like, you know, Ruby and Python.
One of the Microsoft technologies which relies very heavily on static typing, as far as I understand it, is Link.
Yes.
There are some interesting questions there, but let's not...
So there is Link support that got checked into Silverlight, just so you know that as well.
Really?
Yep, yep. So system.core.dll contains Link to objects, right? And or Link for objects, and that stuff's in there. And in fact, that's what we're showing as part of the Jim and John talk. We're actually going to bring VB in from. We're going to grab some data from Technorati, as it turns out, and we're going to use a Link expression, right, to go off against that data.
The idea would be here that part of this cooperation that can occur from language to language on the .NET substrate is one which leverages, let's say, VB's capability to exploit Link.
Yes.
You know, and then tie some other stuff which might be happening in a more dynamic part of the application.
Right. What's really interesting about this is you can kind of pick the best features of each language, right? And exploit those things. You know, so if you feel that Active Record, for example, right, out of Rails is not the best object relational mapper, right? Because it doesn't do the right kinds of optimizations for queries, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, at some point you're going to drop down to actually specifying the SQL for certain types of queries.
Right.
But what's interesting about, you know, using the Link stuff, right, is that if your mapping provider is smart enough, he can do the optimizations on your behalf before sending them out over the wire. So I think that becomes a very interesting scenario for people to start thinking about, right, especially if you're building these applications that run down inside of the browser.
Well, since you mentioned Rails, for a long time I've actually had the idea that, well, actually for a very long time, I've had the idea going back to, I think it's been 10 years really since, you remember the original ActiveX scripting host stuff?
Uh-huh.
And the possibility to run, you know, at the time you could run Perl inside the browser and you could Python inside the browser and so on. You know, so we're kind of coming full circle. But nowadays, there are some incredibly interesting frameworks that have built on top of these languages like Rails. And so, I mean, is it meaningful to think about client-side Rails? What would that, you know, what would that buy you? I mean, it seems like it might be.
That's a really interesting question. We don't have enough of Ruby working, right, to start exploring those kinds of things yet.
Okay.
But, you know, we will, you know. And so it's one of these chicken and egg things that we have to get done first.
Okay. Doesn't run Rails yet.
Rails is by far the most complicated library that's out there right now in the Ruby world. And it will be a wonderful test case, right, you know, when we can start running that. But Rails uses virtually every metaprogramming trick in the book inside of Ruby to do its thing. And,
yes.
And so it's going to be a great forcing function again for us to have a high quality implementation.
So to talk about Silverlight,
mm-hmm.
I believe that there's been some confusion about the fact that the February tech preview that was announced and released got people thinking in terms of the Ajax and JavaScript support.
Sure.
You know, what has been seen so far of Silverlight is a thing which is kind of this opaque runtime that you stick into a web page and then kind of automate from the outside using JavaScript, which it is actually a pretty interesting and important thing. I mean, I just noticed the other day that probably means that grease monkey-like things can happen.
And I really love that observation there, because I think there's some really interesting things that you can do with user-modified web pages that way, or Silverlight pages in this case.
Yeah. What hasn't been seen, and I guess this is the major Silverlight announcement, is the support now for access to .NET programming of the objects that are stuck onto those web pages, of the Silverlight objects, right?
Yes, absolutely. The actual engine of the Silverlight VTP, and it's still the same core engine, right, that's in the version of Silverlight that we will be delivering an alpha for at Mix. Same rendering engine, except that in the version that we're delivering at Mix, we also have managed wrappers around all of the animation and video support and things that we saw, so that we can now program all of those things, not just from native browser JavaScript, right, whatever your browser happened to be, but you can also program that stuff from any of the managed languages and from any of the DLR languages as well. We've got a trimmed down version of the CLR, right, which runs inside of the browser, right, so to try and get things within the size constraints that we want to have the good download experience for people.
Yep.
So that version of the CLR will be able to run C# code that you can build against the subset of the libraries, right, that are going to be available down in the client.
And it should go without saying that things that are built for the little CLR will run on its big brother.
Yes.
And that's a pretty interesting idea as well. Although I suppose that part of what happens here is that for those of us who have had our hands on enough of these different pieces, and even for us, I think, it starts to get a little bit complicated to sort of sit down and think through how all these layers and components interact, right? You know, because we have, you know, the entire substrate of web technologies still very much in play, right? So, you know, as a developer now, you know, you're looking at all of the things that were relevant for Ajax-style development, which is a lot of things, right?
Yep.
It's CSS, it's JavaScript, it's HTML, it's a ton of stuff in that domain. And, you know, now we bring in a whole other set of things. It's, to folks like you and me, it's pretty invigorating. It's also potentially kind of scary. You know, this is one of those age-old arguments about, well, of course, no real developer only just uses one language, right? Everyone has to be multilingual, and these days, quite aggressively multilingual.
Right.
Well, I guess what I'm leading up here to is trying to get from you a sense of the way in which the tools that are being developed to generate XAML and to generate a lot of this stuff, you know, are going to play in this environment. And my understanding is that they will very strongly.
So there's this idea that I've been trying to crystallize as all of this stuff has been coming together. And it's the observation that essentially, if you look at a Silverlight application that's not using a compiled C# assembly in it, everything is text. HTML page is text. The XAML is text.
Yes.
Right? All of the source code for the various, you know, JavaScript or Ruby or Python code that you're going to be writing, that's all text as well.
Hmm.
So this is very similar to the original web, right?
Yes.
Everything was just text.
Yes.
And the community is able to learn extremely rapidly by essentially saying, well, that guy built that interesting, I wonder how he did it. So effectively, this is open source, right?
It's view source, let's say.
It's view source, exactly.
Yes.
So people are going to be able to learn extremely rapidly, and I think that's the thing, right, that makes Silverlight such an interesting platform, is that it's all text-based, and people are going to be able to look at a wealth of samples that are going to be out there and actual implementations and figure out how to do things.
So if I, in fact, pull down a Silverlight-enriched page that's doing the things that you just mentioned, which is to say it's doing JavaScript automation of objects, some of those objects are XAML text, and some of those objects are script text. Let's say Ruby or Python.
Yep.
I'm actually going to see all of that text on a view source?
Not depending on what your browser is going to do, right? But yeah, you could figure out what files are being retrieved from the server and just go look at them.
So it's like the equivalent of a script source for JavaScript. It would be a source of one of these other things, and it's a one-level indirect. And I can actually get there and see what that thing is.
Yeah,
right?
And I figure it won't be long before somebody adds some extension to Firefox that will just show you all the source for everything.
Which also says that people are going to immediately go to the next level of craziness, which is the dynamic generation of the script text, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yep. So forget about just generating text, right? We'll just metaprogram everything, right?
Yeah.
And, so languages like Ruby and Python, right, which have very powerful metaprogramming facilities, right, that, I suspect lots of stuff will be done that way.
Yeah, which will create its own, as usual, create its own debugging challenges, but...
Yes. One of the really cool things that we're showing at Mix as well, and that is if you're developing on the Mac, you can actually attach Visual Studio to the CLR running on the Mac over a network link and be able to step through your code running inside of Safari.
Really?
On a Mac.
Yes. Really? You've done this?
Yes.
Awesome.
So one of the criticisms, right, of, you know, certainly Ruby, right, for the longest time, right, is crappy debugging support. right?
Yes.
And, you know, so what Rails guys do is they use breakpointer, and, you know, they set this breakpoint so they can pop into the console, they can start pointing around. That's powerful. I don't want to really denigrate it, right? But it's kind of cool to be able to see your call stack and all the other things that we've been able to do for a long time in more traditional debuggers.
Right. Well, and, you know, I would have to say this has been one of the sore spots with Ajax generally, is the difficulty of doing that. I mean, there are, well, as you know, really quite strong JavaScript debugging facilities like Venkman. Even so, it's sometimes tricky to get at what you need to get at. So
it becomes even more important when you're doing the wacky metaprogramming stuff, right? Because it's now much harder to visualize what's going on inside of your application.
Yeah.
This thing is the really exciting part, right? Is this brand new platform, you know, with all of these dynamic languages, and to just be able to sit back and see what folks outside are going to be able to use this bag of technology to create. Right. I can imagine people creating some really, really interesting things. And back to the, you know, what about a Rails-like thing, right, that runs inside of the browser, written on top of Ruby, that runs inside of the browser? I think that's a wonderful project, right, for people to go off and start trying to tackle. Certainly, the libraries that are going to ship with the Mix CTP that we're putting out there are quite limited, right? So, you know, you've got essentially, it's more or less the moral equivalent of GDI, right? You can paint text on the screen, you can draw boxes and ellipses and hook up event handlers and do hit detection and that kind of stuff. Mm. That's it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We are shipping in sample form a number of controls, like a button, a list box, you know, a scroll box and things like that. But, you know, those things are going to be in sample form, and we haven't quite decided exactly, you know, whether or not these things are going to be things in the platform, whether or not they're just going to be sample things so that the community can more easily contribute controls back into that.
So that actually reminds me to ask about this question of sort of DOM interplay between the HTML DOM and the XAML DOM.
Yep.
You know, I know that it goes in the direction of reaching into the XAML DOM and doing things with it from JavaScript.
Yep.
Can this .NET code go the other direction and, you know, leverage the HTML pages sort of native componentry?
Absolutely. And in fact, due to some of those limitations that I just brought up earlier, for example, there's no text box control. So there's no easy way, right, for you to go off and just, you know, do text input. So I've written a bunch of samples that essentially just reach back out into, you know, an input type is equal to text element right inside of your page, right, and retrieve user entered input out of that thing.
Accessing the HTML DOM from the Silverlight runtime.
Exactly. Yeah. It's actually really interesting, right? We can do some very nice metaprogramming there as well, right, from the DLR. And so one of the features that we have inside of Python, for example, is it's system.browser.html.page.document, right? It's how you wind up referencing essentially the document object inside of the HTML DOM.
Mm-hmm.
With some fancy little importy tricks that we can do in Python, right, that just simply becomes document dot. Now, it could be document dot get elements by ID, right, which is the DOM-like way to find a named element in the page.
Mm-hmm.
But what we have is a mechanism whereby we can pre-populate that document object in the DLR with all of the names from within the HTML page. So you can now say, so let's say your input element was called user input, right? So you can now go document.userInput.value to retrieve its value.
Or potentially you could scan that namespace on the .NET side using other search and scanning mechanisms just within its own purview.
Yep.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yep, absolutely.
What's the sort of security sandbox situation going to be? In other words, and the reason I ask is in terms of what's going to be possible in terms maybe of offline applications and things like that.
The really interesting thing, because you brought up a number of interesting points, right? The first was, you know, the original iActivScript observation, right?
Yeah.
Essentially, you said, well, you know what? Like, yeah, sure, we could have already taken Python, right, and implement iActivScript on it and stuff it into the browser, and it would just work. The question you have to ask is, well, why hasn't that taken off? And I think part of the reason for this is this observation. And that is, when you're plugging a control like that, right, which is all unmanaged code, into the browser, that thing has to at least be as secure as the browser itself, right? So now all of a sudden, you really have to make sure you go through all of the security practices to make sure that there is no way that someone could go off and, you know, fuzz your language or do something else to get a buffer overrun and exploit that to gain control over the machine. Very high bar, right, for people just implementing languages, right,
yeah,
to go off and make that happen.
Yep.
The really impressive part about the DLR is that the DLR runs in a security transparent mode. inside of the managed code stack inside of the browser.
Security transparent?
Security transparent, right? So what that means is that the DLR and all the crazy code generation stuff that we do right, inside of the DLR does not have to call any privileged APIs whatsoever.
Okay.
Right? So privileged API would be, you know, writing the file system, those kinds of things, right?
Okay.
But, you know, we don't have to call a single privileged API. Anybody that builds a language on top of us that goes off and, you know, does crazy things to generate code, right? That's also security transparent.
Okay.
So that means that all of the heavy lifting, right, of essentially guaranteeing that you are not doing something that is illegal that could lead to an exploit has been done by the engineering efforts of the CLR team.
Right.
Big, big, big win.
Yes. Right?
Because that's just an awful lot of stuff that there's a lot of pain that's involved, right, in going through security code reviews.
Yeah.
Right, to make sure that if you are in that position where you are calling these security-sensitive APIs, that you must audit all of your code paths going into that, right, and subject that to very, very intensive review.
Yeah.
We didn't have to go through any of that.
One of the things that has made me most uncomfortable about the various open source dynamic languages over the years is, you know, their sort of tendency to reimplement the world in terms of their libraries. And so, you know, I for a long time have been feeling that, you know, inevitably these languages were going to converge on a couple of runtimes, you know, .NET and Java primarily.
Right.
If only to sort of consolidate that effort, you know, so otherwise, like, you know, there has to be somebody whose job it is to do the LDAP library for Ruby, and somebody has to do it for this language and that language.
Yes.
All this, yeah. All this just, you know,
duplicated effort.
Redundant effort, you know, but the point that you make also is apart from eliminating redundancy, this buys you a lot of peace of mind.
There are people out there that like to make the argument about genetic diversity in software, right? But the reality is that software is not nowhere near diverse enough, right, to benefit from the benefits that you do get from actual genetic diversity.
Well, actually, I think that, you know, my argument would be that this gives us still all of the potential benefits of diversity in the sense that in each of these different language environments, you know, there are going to be libraries which are emerging, like Rails is emerging from the Ruby space, you know, and over time, if and when those things get to a critical level of popularity and importance, they can migrate into the common framework. And I think that's a really nice flow for things to develop that way.
Yeah.
So we were going to come back to the offline possibility.
Right.
Which probably there isn't one right now, but.
Well, certainly not in the mix CTP, right?
Yeah.
We had enough on our hands just getting that thing out the door. But certainly, yes, there are definitely plans, right, to add, you know, an offline disconnect story to that as well. And the details of that are still being worked out right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's really nothing that I have to say about that. I personally don't have knowledge outside of hallway conversations about what that's going to be.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, that's definitely going to be one of the things. And the possibility of just doing really innovative client stuff, being able to connect up to arbitrary web services in the cloud, and all sorts of work that we have to do, right, to make that easier and less painful and stuff for people to do.
Let's just review what you said about connecting to arbitrary services in the cloud.
Yes.
So there's, if I source a Silverlight enriched page from some site, then my code can go off to other sites, or how is that handled?
We are following more or less a very, very restrictive security model, which is to say that if I want to make a browser HTTP web request, I can only make it back to the origin server that I came from.
Mm-hmm.
Any of our samples that do things like go off to Technorati or something else, right, to go grab some data, right, we bounce everything through a redirector.
Okay.
Right, on the origin side.
Okay.
We have to do some work, right, to figure out what it would be like, right, to go off to arbitrary URLs within the same security zone, right, that you came from. That becomes more complicated when you consider that, you know, outside of IE, there aren't really browsers, like Firefox doesn't have a notion of security zones. So it becomes more tricky, right, to detect when you're crossing those kinds of boundaries.
How will this relate to all of the existing AJAX-y XML HTTP object stuff? Can it leverage that?
Yes.
Okay.
So essentially anything you can do, but respecting whatever the browser security policy happens to be, right, for those things.
Right.
So, you know, like the JavaScript, you know, hacks notwithstanding, right, for people using, you know, the script tag to go off and grab data, right, from arbitrary places.
Right.
The reality is people can do all these things today, and we are locking it down in this very important scenario, which is the one that I think a lot of people are doing. This is sort of like saying, well, if there is a security hole, well, the front door is already open, right?
Yes.
And maybe we want to open a window as well. But the right thing to do, of course, is to make sure that we do the right thing to analyze the security implications of doing this properly, and not just the paranoid, you can't do it, right, and just lock people down,
but
to do have a really good understanding of what it involves to allow you to do, you know, cross-domain access within the same security zone and whether or not you are actually opening up new vulnerabilities by doing so.
This sounds very promising. So
sure.
What exactly are you announcing and when are you announcing it?
At Scott's keynote on Monday, we are going to be announcing the DLR. We
okay.
are going to be announcing Ruby. We're going to be announcing the other languages, but you know, Python's kind of like a done deal already. But VB and JS, a managed JS as well, are the two other pieces I don't think people know about.
The managed JavaScript is or is not a descendant of JScript.net?
It is a completely different implementation.
Oh, wow. The demo that you and Jim are doing, when is that scheduled for?
So that is Tuesday at 11:45.
I won't even be there, but I'll have to watch the movie.
The thing we are showing right up at the start in the keynote is this really wonderful application that Jim wrote, which is the DLR console.
Okay.
So the DLR console is essentially a language console hosted entirely inside of the browser that runs all of the code locally, right, inside of your browser in all four of the dynamic languages. And you can switch between each language. You can type a line of code in Ruby,
mm-hmm.
click on something, switch over to JS, type a line of code in JS and have it execute. That line of code in JS could actually reference a variable, let's say, that you defined in the line of Ruby code for that, to show the cross-language interop
mm-hmm.
seamlessly.
Mm-hmm.
It also has the ability to manipulate XAML elements on inside of the browser as well. So imagine that you're looking at the browser and it's split between the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the browser window. Left-hand side is where you're typing your code. Right-hand side is a XAML canvas.
Yeah.
And so we've got little bits and samples in there where we're injecting, you know, pretty-looking things into the right-hand side and manipulating them from the scripting languages on the left-hand side.
This is already possible in Iron Python. In fact, Jim demonstrates things like that in the screencast that he did with me. And in a way, in fact, he's even shown the cross-language piece of it, because part of that demo that he did in our screencast was the Iron Python to VB thing.
Sure. But the cool thing about this is that, remember all those things I talked about the pieces that are missing inside of Silverlight? Things like text input, right? And how, you know, most people are going to be delegating HTML controls, right?
Yeah.
Well, no. Jim actually implemented all of that stuff. And and in about 2,000 lines of Python code, this windowing system with tabs and syntax coloring of the languages and XAML and all that stuff, right? It's by far the most comprehensive sample that we have that does something real.
Cool.
So that's going to actually be shipped out as an external sample as well, right? So people can go off and grab the bits and play with that as well. And it auto-detects all of the different languages. We're only shipping, so you know, I'm not sure this is clear, we're only shipping Python and JavaScript inside of the CTP that we're releasing at Mix.
Okay.
So Ruby and VB are both left out. Right?
Okay.
Because both languages aren't in a state that would be ready for outside people to play with them. Once those things come online, right, the DLR console will just take those things up.
It sounds great. I think that what we've said here will, in fact, appeal primarily to dynamic language junkies after all.
Yep.
But I hope that, you know, I hope that we've made it at least a little bit accessible to a wider audience, because, like I say, I've struggled over the years to articulate more broadly why this stuff matters and have mm-hmm. mostly failed. But I think I'm starting to get a little bit better at it.
Well, dynamic languages, I feel personally, right, it's all about expressing my intent.
Yeah.
Right. I find that when I'm coding in other languages that it's harder for me to express what I say, and it's harder for me to read somebody else's code to figure out what they meant to say.
Especially that, yeah.
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 Right, because it's much harder to read somebody else's code than write your own.
Yep.
So that's the part that I really like about dynamic languages. And, you know, partially it's, you know, the terseness of the syntax and, you know, and the different expressive capabilities that you have in there versus, you know, other languages. But what's very interesting to me is just how languages like C# are getting so much of the feel of dynamic languages now.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So getting some of the line noise out of C# is a wonderful thing.
Yes.
You know, and things like extension methods now, right? Like, wow, I can just walk up to some arbitrary type and stick some more methods on it, right?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Right, you know.
Kind of funny what ends up catching people's fancy. I remember talking to Jim about Iron Python when he first was showing it to people at Microsoft, and he said he had done all this stuff, and the part that really wowed people was the read, eval, print loop, because it just hadn't been part of the culture. And so something as, you know, from a certain perspective as basic and ancient as that is in mm-hmm. other contexts actually kind of a revelation. I mean, I can just kind of line by line, I can kind of explore these objects and make things happen on the screen and, you know, and play. And
but what's interesting is that stuff exists in parts of the company already, right? So, for example, the SQL stuff, right? The iSQLW application.
Mm-hmm.
You type a bunch of SQL in a window. You can either run the whole window or you can select a region of that window and run just the stuff that you selected.
Right.
Right. So that culture has been in SQL for a long time.
Yeah.
And it's actually a really interesting place for us to spend some time exploring, you know, once we get some time, is just what it means, like what does a development environment for a dynamic language look like?
Yep.
What percentage of people will be using a traditional IDE like a Visual Studio to build their dynamic language applications versus, you know, these other kind of more interactive kinds of mechanisms, right, for writing the code? I think that's actually a very interesting place to explore some more. And DLR console is just really just the tip of the iceberg in terms of like the thoughts that we have in this, in mm-hmm, this area mm-hmm. That we really want to try and, you know, and explore further when we have some more time.
Sounds really good, and I'll be looking forward to seeing this on Monday. And thanks for your time, John.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay.